Cachimbonas, welcome to Radio Cachimbona. Radio Cachimbona is an abolitionist podcast that audio archives state repression and fierce migrant resistance in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands and breaks down case law and politics from a leftist perspective. As the daughter of Salvadoran immigrants, Yvette prioritizes uplifting the voices and histories of Central Americans. This is a special episode that is a recording of a panel that I participated in at the AALS 2026 annual conference. This was a joint program with the International Human Rights and International Law sections of AALS, and the panel was titled Deportation, Due Process, and Human Dignity. I was super honored to be invited to speak on this panel by Professor Raquel Aldana of UC Davis Law, and it was one of my first opportunities to speak on my forthcoming article that I've been working on during my time as the Laura Gomez Fellow, which will soon be published by the NYU Journal of International Law and Politics. It is titled Participatory Deportation Defense, Becoming Abogados de Confianza. It's not out yet, but will be soon. However, very willing and excited to share the draft that I have now with any cachimbonas that would like to read it. Email radiocachimbona@gmail.com and I will gladly send you the draft that I have. I would love to hear everyone's thoughts. The program description is something I'm going to read to you all now because I think it will help situate the conversation that we had and the remarks of each panelist. As we bear witness to the brutality of indiscriminate immigration enforcement in our own backyards, and as our nation turns its back on our legal obligations to protect even asylum seekers and unaccompanied minors, courageous and multifaceted movements of resistance have been rising. Uniting the resistance is the growing recognition that immigrant oppression and restrictive borders have functioned as powerful tools to maintain domestic and global systems of social and economic repression for the benefit of the few. The power of racialized and xenophobic tropes has scapegoated immigrants to stoke hatred and fear among the quote native oppressed, and to blind us to our shared humanity and to the commonality of our lived experiences with our, quote, foreign brethren. In a world that has become too unequal, too greedy, and too corrupt to serve the public good, calls for liberation grow louder to include voices for a reimagination of borders and even the possibility of freedom of movement as a bedrock human rights principle that should shape our imagination of a better world moving forward. This broader project of liberation has necessitated new strategies and models of resistance that center the voices of impacted communities, emphasize the intersectionality of oppression, and consider alternatives to legal reform, including what Professor Jennifer Lee has called immigration disobedience. This panel brings together academics and activists who have theorized and implemented these new strategies of resistance. They include legal academics, lawyers, and immigrant activists working together within and at times outside the bounds of law to include spiritual practices, protests, and other forms of advocacy to push back against tyranny and to fight for the human dignity of all, including immigrants. The moderator of the panel, like I mentioned, is Raquel Aldana, Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at UC Davis, and I was so honored to be a part of this panel with my fellow esteemed panelists that included Giselle Garcia, Project Director at NorCal Resist, Layla Loss, Associate Professor of Law and Co-Director of the Immigrants' Rights Clinic at Tulane University Law School, Cynthia Ibarra, former organizer at the Philly Climate Works, Evelyn Rangel Medina, Assistant Professor of Law at Temple University Beasley School of Law, and Bambi Salcedo, President and CEO of the Trans Latina Coalition, and Tanya Wolf, Southeast Advocacy Manager at the National Immigration Project. We had a really rich discussion, and I'm so sure that the Cachimbonas will enjoy this episode. If you enjoy this episode and want to support it, you should support via the Patreon, patreon.com/radiocachimbona. You know, this is a moment of, it's a fork in the road for the United States. Whether the weak infrastructure, the weak democratic infrastructure that exists, whether it will be preserved to fight another day, or whether this country will divert into full-blown fascist authoritarianism. And I think what direction the fork will take is actually predicated on whether or not this country is willing to accept and embrace the immigrants who want to become a part of this country. And if you believe this as well, if you want others to know this, if you want to do your part to ensure that we get on the right fork of the road, then please consider joining the Patreon. If my commentary is something that's of value to you, if you want me to put out more regular content, then you have to support via the Patreon. This is a time where everybody needs to be involved in politics, broadly defined, and if it's not your day job, if it's something that you want to be involved in but don't quite know how, becoming a Patreon, listening to these episodes, and sharing it with other people is a fantastic way to get started. So please join the Patreon. You won't just be supporting, you also get access to dozens, I think actually now there's hundreds of lit review episodes, which is a segment that I did exclusively for the Patreons and am planning on still doing, by the way. It's a book club for Cachimbonas, and I think it's myself and other women of color digesting important books, stories, texts, and I think there's something for everyone in the Patreon. So please, if you haven't already joined the Patreon community, you can do so for $3, $5, or $10 a month, whatever it is that you're able to give, will support the podcast. I believe that being listener funded allows me to keep the political integrity of the podcast intact. If you ever wonder, you know, what differentiates Radio Cachimbona from other political podcasts, I think that that is it, that it's completely listener funded and that there is no filtering of my opinion. The link to join the Patreon is always in the show notes and in the link in bio on my Instagram at Radio Cachimbona. Please follow at Radio Cachimbona on Instagram, X, and Facebook. If you want to, if something from an episode particularly struck you, please feel free to leave comments there to keep the conversation going. And another 100% free way to join, or sorry, to support the podcast is to leave an Apple Podcast or Spotify rating or review. It helps new listeners join the podcast and personally motivates me to keep going. Thank you to Grant Bloom for the intro and audio editing, as always. I hope that you all enjoy this episode. Bye, Cachimbonas.
Good morning. We weren't sure we were going to have an audience at 8 o'clock in the morning on a Friday. So the fact that you're here is absolutely fabulous. Thank you. And this panel is being co-sponsored by the International Human Rights and International Law. It's a joint program, so thank you for doing that, because it's important to have immigration be part of the conversation around international law and human rights. My name is Raquel Aldana, and I teach at UC Davis School of Law. And the title of this panel is deportation due process. Just so you know, it is going to be recorded because we will be featuring it as part of a podcast that event for Ha runs called Kachimbona, but the audience questions will be cut out, so you don't have to worry about that. That's why we didn't get your permission. Just wanted you to be aware. So this panel features the love and courage that have propelled a movement of resistance against the cruelty and trauma that immigrants are experiencing daily in our nation today. After more than a century of failed efforts to tame the illegality and trauma wielded by borders, we have come to a moment of moral reckoning, one that requires a reimagination of borders and the adoption of freedom of movement as a bedrock human rights principle. This broader project of adapting of liberation has necessitated new strategies and models of resistance that center the voices of impacted communities, emphasize the intersectionality of oppression, and consider alternatives beyond legal reform, including what Professor Jennifer Lee has called immigration disobedience. This panel brings together academics and activists who have theorized and implemented these new strategies of resistance. They are working together within and at times outside the bounds of law to include spiritual practices, protest, and other forms of advocacy to push back against tyranny and to fight for the human dignity of immigrants. So today we will have three presentations by three groups of scholar activist collaborators. They will each speak for 15 minutes. I'll provide a very brief introduction of the three groups, and we'll have to dispense with the accolades just so that we can get started. The first group is going to be with Evelyn Rangel Medina, who teaches, this is Evelyn, who teaches and writes in the areas of immigration and criminal procedure, employment discrimination and race in the law, among other topics. She's an incredibly young but amazing scholar who's really setting up new boundaries for the ways that we think about borders. And she has partnered with Bambi Salcedo, who was our organizer this morning. Blink, 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 love it. And she's the president and CEO of the Translatina Coalition. She's also partnering with Cynthia Ibarra, who is a recent graduate of Temple, where Professor Medina teaches. And she's going to be joining us virtually this morning. Thank you, Cynthia. And they're involved in a participatory scholarship project that explores the spiritual and ancestral strength that fuels how they as immigrants or from immigrant families transcend borders to seek to live fully realized lives as individuals within their communities. Our second group is comprised of Yvette Borja, who is the Laura E. Gomez Teaching Fellow on Latinx People and the Law at UCLA. And also Giselle Garcia, who is the Programs Director at NorCal Resist. Each respectively worked in Tucson, Arizona, or in Sacramento, California, during times of severe strain on immigrant communities during the Trump administration. Each has worked in partnership with communities in resistance, many who are themselves immigrants. And based on her experience in Tucson, Professor Borja co-authored a forthcoming piece titled Abogades de Confianza, which describes a different model of lawyering that centers the wisdom and voices of immigrants and resistance. Giselle Garcia is currently living this model of courageous resistance with thousands of other organized community members who are using literally their bodies, their voices, and hearts to stand up to ICE, often physically, as you can imagine, at incredible lethal risk to themselves, as we have learned. So together, they will explore the possibility and tensions that arise when lawyers recenter the law in their own, or decenter the law in their own voices as the path forward. And finally, we will hear from Professor Leila Halas, a professor at Tulane and co-director of the Immigrant Rights Clinic, who has paired up with the National Immigration Project, including Tanya Wolf, who had to get up and deal with her wonderful dog this morning, saying, "Where are you going?" who is the Southeast Advocacy Manager, an immigration abolitionist project that aims to end detention or free children and youth from the exploitation of law. In 2002, Professor Halas published a piece in the California Law Review titled "Lawyering from a Deportation Abolition and Abolition Ethics." And she will draw on those insights to discuss her work in partnership with the National Immigration Project, which, as you know, has been as the forefront of litigation and other advocacy strategies to fend off Trump 2.0. So thank you for joining us this morning. Let's get started.
Buenos dias. Good morning. It's truly a privilege and an honor to be sitting next to these powerful warriors, both within the academy, within law school, and within the movement. And I'm so grateful to Professor Raquel Aldana for being courageous and the visionary behind putting together a panel in really helping to alleviate some of the frustration that we've experienced in legal circles and academic circles around people being surprised or taken aback about what's happening with ICE and immigration enforcement and how it's being used as a mechanism not only for racial control and terror, but to really curtail the rights of undocumented people, non-citizens, and citizens alike, centered around in a anti-Brown animus. And so really, I think the intervention is to bring to the forefront the visionaries and the movement builders who are at the forefront. And that includes some of us, that includes some of our histories. And so I won't spend a lot of time talking because I think it's more important that you hear from Bambi and Cynthia on our project as well as the other panelists. But it's really, our project is titled, and it's inspired by Bambi's story. In her bio, she says that it is a miracle that she's alive and that she shouldn't really be here. And so kind of one of the things that we're gonna explore in our forthcoming article, which is titled Unearthing Milagros, Unearthing Miracles, A Rooted Vision of Liberation. And so Bambi, Cynthia, and I will use a participatory law scholarship framework to center our lived experience as immigrants, as movement builders, as Mexicanas who have long histories of and lineages of our families being impacted and traumatized and subverting this incredibly racist and evil regime of immigration enforcement. And but more than centering that, everything that we've survived, which I think most of the world is starting to see the curtain being lifted, right? The incredible violence that's been inflicted for centuries upon racialized immigrant communities. We're gonna put our collective hearts, spirits, and minds together in outlining how should we regulate migration from a dignity standpoint, from a standpoint that does not gender bodies or privilege certain cis bodies, that centers indigenous people, black people, people of color, and specifically the most vulnerable people on earth. Because when we think about undocumented migration, those are the human beings that we're talking about, the people who have been displaced by failed nation state policies and that are continuing to be displaced and marginalized once they arrive into the United States. And so I'm really excited about it. And we're really, I also feel honored to work with Professor Rachel Lopez. That's her theoretical framework that she's been developing over the last couple of years, participatory law scholarship, so I'll pass it on to Bambi to share her perspective. You want to go Cynthia first?
Yeah,
okay. Cynthia, we'll pass it to you. Can you hear us? Yeah.
Dale, Cynthia.
Thank you so much. And good morning, everybody. It's an honor to be here. It's also a very sobering time to be here. considering there's so much uncertainty across our communities, constant attacks across the board. And so I'll begin to orient our conversation with a little bit of a background about me. As a Mexicana with multiple marginalized identities, I really deeply understand the importance of community organizing and coalition building. My lived experiences alongside my families, my communities, as part of the immigrant working class, have consistently steered me towards this path, towards a path of collective liberation. I grew up hearing in my community when I was younger just about the constant exploitation in the workplace, racist discrimination, verbal harassment. And at the time, the xenophobia, these attacks on immigrants were not new to me. They were something that was the norm for my community and for others. These experiences were a constant in my life as I witnessed the trials and tribulations of my family and the broader community. And to me, it seemed in a way that it was kind of the price to pay to be an immigrant in this nation, that these conditions that we relentlessly faced were under the belief that it was a sacrifice that we must endure to keep our families fed. And so, as Professor Rangel Medina mentioned, part of that veil is starting to lift. Unfortunately, it has been at the cost of so many human lives, so many people's stories. And though that has been a price that we've paid, it's a price that we must no longer continue to pay. And so ultimately, I want to just, again, uplift that collective liberation and emancipation of all carceral people. My priority is not necessarily reforming these systems, but rather the abolition of ICE, ICE detention, and all carceral systems that have needed so that it seems like this has to be the price that we pay. Immigrants are forced to endure inhumane conditions in ICE detention centers. They lose their dignity while private prisons' profits surge. And so the first step to eradicate this is to free all detained immigrants. And it may seem like a radical thing, but, you know, as an abolitionist, like, across the board, I think when we think of eliminating and abolishing carceral systems, we really do have to grapple with what this means to free all detained immigrants, all people held in carceral systems, and to provide them with legal pathways to citizenship, or at the very least, an immigration process by which immigrants can freely enter and exit this country. I think another piece that is imperative is that when we do this work, we are informed by our ancestors, by historical movements in the past as well, because there's no way that we can move forward without understanding the history. And so I also want to focus on the piece that as we begin to come to terms with what all of this violence towards our community has meant, it's important to know that it may be new to some people, but it has been the reality for many communities, lots of generations. Racial equity, I think, is another piece that is important to the work and the opportunities that I've sought out. I've also grappled with the reality that the people that look most like me in the legal field are not necessarily the people that are representing my community. It's oftentimes very same community members that are in these spaces. And so, again, I think as we continue the work towards collective liberation, it is really important that we center voices that have historically been silenced. As an immigrant myself, I have been in spaces where most of the conversation has been driven by people's perspectives of what justice can look like for immigrants. However, oftentimes the people leading these discussions are not necessarily immigrants themselves, and it is important to understand that though one lived experience doesn't have, you know, more importance than other lived experiences, I do think that it is necessary to begin to think about what a better future can look like. This type of creative envisioning of what a better world can look like is, you know, it's a disservice to this imagining a better future if we don't really engage with what the material conditions of people have been like. And I'll just end a little bit about this just long spiel, just saying that we must continue to grapple with these realities. and to really understand that the racialized criminalizations of immigrants that we're seeing today is not new. It has been present throughout centuries, it has been present throughout generations. And in order to move forward, we have to honor the historical struggles of our ancestors, of our communities, in order to create a better world. And with that, I will pass it to Bambi.
Primero que nada, gracias a Dios, gracias a la vida, gracias a la tierra, y gracias a todas las personas que están aquí presente. I know that it was probably hard for some of you to understand what I just said, but before I speak, I always express my gratitude and appreciation to my higher power for allowing me to live one more day. I also acknowledge the land where we're standing on today, and I also honor your presence. So thank you so much for being here this early. I was like, oh, there's three people here, yay. You know, but I truly appreciate that you took the time to be here and to collectively learn from one another. I want to ask a question. How many of you are active lawyers, like practicing? And I'm imagining some of you are professors and stuff like that. Thank you. Thank you for what you do. Thank you for teaching the new generation of, you know, individuals who can potentially, you know, create the changes that need to happen as we have been talking about for a long time. So thank you for influencing that. I think it's important for us to understand that, you know, particularly legal systems have been oppressive, right? And how we can contribute to actually change that, right? Because we know that the law is interpreted however we want to interpret it, right? And whatever we learn, that's how we practice and that's how we carry out. But one of the things that I don't think is often considered is this this frame of what truly social justice means, right? And also including those who are the most marginalized, the most oppressed. And that includes, obviously, trans, gender expansive, and intersex people, right? And so I am so appreciative that I am here with this amazing and incredible scholars and activists who invited me to be part of this conversation, right? Because we don't see this a lot. We don't see people like myself being in spaces that obviously are not created for people like myself, right? And so oftentimes we either have to kick doors to be open for us or have intentional people like the people who are here to invite us to be part of these. And so for that, I'm so appreciative. You know, I am a living example of the issues, hopes and dreams of trans, gender expansive, and intersex people. I am a survivor of the carceral system, including immigration detention. I am one that actually has survived some of the things that, you know, Cynthia and everybody is going to be talking about, right? I was brutally attacked in immigration detention. I have seen some of my friends who have been murdered by the carceral immigration detention system, denying them medications and, you know, being sexually assaulted and brutally attacked, such as myself. And so, you know, when we are able to survive and when we are able to express our experiences and our survival, right, it's important for these conversations, for us to write about, right? To bring these conversations into the spaces again that we are often excluded from. And because of my life experiences, I now have the privilege to be the CEO of, to my understanding, is now the biggest translator organization in the United States. And of course, it has not been easy, right? And especially right now, when we, as people, as you know, trans, gender expansive, and intersex identified individuals are, you know, there's an act of genocide to eradicate all of us, right? And I don't know if people understand what genocide really means, or how, you know, some of the things that people do to actually create the genocide happens, right? But that is the truth. That is what is happening. Even though we may not want to see it that way, that is the actual practice that is happening against our community. And we have to, as a community, as an organization, we have to continue to exist, right? And the Trans Latina Coalition, you know, we believe in supporting our people, and organizing our people and empowering our people through service provision, right? Because you can't really organize people if people are struggling with basic things like housing and food and, you know, the things that many of us take for granted, right? While at the same time, we also believe in changing or influencing change in the institutions that have marginalized us and continue to marginalize us, right? And so we do policy and training. We create our own content, so, you know, check us out. I mean, actually subscribe to our YouTube channel. We have a lot of education that you can use in your classes, or you can actually benefit from, and that you can perhaps learn, right, about who we are as people. And so definitely want to extend that invitation. I know that our time is limited, but there's so much to talk about. But what I do want to leave you with, and hopefully charge you with, it's truly understand that trans, gender expansive, and intersex people have existed for centuries, right? And we will continue to be here. I can tell you that that can only happen if we are intentional about supporting our community, right? And if we are, I know that we are able, but if we are willing to interpret the law the way it's supposed to, right? And really fight for our communities. Because, you know, you all are the ones that could actually fight back with the law, right? And so I know that it is possible. I can tell you that for me, hope is what has allowed me to be here for almost 30 years doing this work. And I'm not scared. I'm not scared. I can tell you that, you know, I am one of the people who they want to get rid of, right? Just for many different things, right? Like, I'm a survivor of the carceral system. You know, I am an immigrant, right? Like, my immigration status is shaky, but whatever, right? Like, that's why I hold dearly and very preciously to say that I am a, que yo soy un milagro, right? That I am a miracle. But I need all of you to step up, right? Just as our community do at this very moment. So with that, I guess I'll turn it over to the next person. Thank you so much.
Your words. I don't want to follow up on you, but I'll try. And please excuse my rage in advance, okay?
You should not excuse yourself.
On May 22nd, 2025, we in Sacramento experienced the first courtroom arrest at the Sacramento Immigration Court.
On May 23rd, the next day, we launched our Court Watch program, and we've monitored the Sacramento Federal Building, which houses ICE, USCIS, FPS, and the Immigration Court every single day until the final docket concludes and the final ICE check-in has checked out, hopefully checked out. In June, ICE started calling Venezuelan men to the ICE office for arbitrary check-ins to inspect their bodies for tattoos. They had an arbitrary list of what they considered to be affiliations with gangs. So the next day, we organized a team of radical tattoo artists to cover up any tattoos that might seem suspicious, including a rose, which was on the list. In July, courtroom arrests peaked in Sacramento. ICE agents pushed our observers to the ground, pinned a woman to the wall by the neck. The court administrator barred us from having access to the courtroom, so we mobilized. We protest, and we shut the courthouse down. We worked with orgs to advocate for our legal right to observe. We called the press. We had a congresswoman exercise her congressional authority to have oversight over the building. We demand access and pushed for a meeting with the assistant chief immigration judge and forced their hand to let us in. We continue to have this uphill battle for access in that courthouse. In August, CBP conducted a raid at a Home Depot in South Sacramento, taking 12 day laborers, many of which were beaten. One of our volunteers and Migra Watch observers arrived on scene to record and lawfully observe the incident when he hears, "He's recording, go get him." And he was pummeled by multiple ICE agents and beaten, and with blood dripping down his face, he was arrested, despite being a citizen. When we found out, we actually found out that the feds were pressing charges against him through a press release that lovely Attorney General Pam Bondi issued, filled with lies and false charges that he now is forced to fight. And so immediately, what did we do? We got one of the best criminal defense attorneys who has plenty of experience helping political activists to protect our guy. We used the press, we supported his family, and expanded our Migra Watch program by calling on white people to use their privilege to observe and document, because they do have a documented better treatment by law enforcement. And so that same month, we then discovered that ICE was holding people for several nights inside of the field office, so an administrative building, okay? These folks, our court watch actually discovered this when they heard their screams from the hallways. And so then we quickly were able to get a lawyer in there despite so much trouble and their attempt to block us. When we discovered that these folks were being denied adequate food, they were given, you know, the mini water bottles, just one of those a day. They were sleeping on the floor in this office cell, essentially, 12 to a room. And so we broke the story. We got the press. We mobilized, we held demos, we shut the court down again, and we called in congressional oversight, challenged the policy, and stopped the practice. Then in October, we tracked an ICE plane en route to a small rural town in Northern California, and we mobilized. And ICE agents checked into their hotels at 8 p.m., and they were checking out by 11 p.m., because of our mobilization. We were able to prevent their planned enforcement action in the community. And lastly, as an example, days after the tragedy of the death of the National Guardsman in DC, on December 1st, six Afghan men were called into the ICE office again for an arbitrary check-in. And they upon walking in, they were arrested. One of them, of which I accompanied, and he was taken from my arms, pinned up against the wall, and handcuffed. In that week, ICE continued to conduct several ICE raids in the communities of predominantly Afghan community members. Visibly, and just it was a visible demonstration of government targeting and persecution. And so we mobilized. We patrolled, our Migra Watch team patrolled those at-risk neighborhoods for hours. We knew that this effort was a targeted and concerted effort by the government because of our presence in the courthouse. We understand more closely what are the kind of strategy and the movement patterns of ICE so that we can then kind of curate our response as a community. And so in 2025, NORCAL Resist ended up providing $128,000 in rent to people who had a loved one, mostly their main financial provider, detained by ICE. We held 62 Know Your Rights presentations, distributed food to 18,000 people, repaired 387 vehicles' brake lights because we want to avoid pretextual law enforcement stops that can escalate, and especially for immigrants and people of color. We completed 430 asylum and work permit applications, paid $75,000 in filing fees for immigration petitions, and wrote 930 letters and sent over $16,000 in commissary for political prisoners and ICE detainees. And so I say this because this was all an entirely organized effort by a community, but led by those who are most impacted. At every step of the way, we consulted with those who were impacted. But while we had, you know, their vision and their perspective, we also understood that those of us who had the privilege of status had to be the ones who put our bodies, right, in harm's way. In protection in their protection, right? And so I just want to end by saying, you know, I went to law school as an organizer thinking that I would come out a lawyer, but I came out a stronger organizer. And none of this is personal, but just my experience. I looked around me when I was in law school and I saw both law students and professors who were just too self-interested to understand the impact of the very laws they professed expertise in and what they had on us. And maybe they understood, but they could not empathize. Most of them couldn't even grow a backbone to recognize a genocide. So I left law school with a profound lack of respect for the legal field and legal professionals. The law to me and the many who experience the wounds inflicted by law as it exists is nothing but a tool for the oppressor to shoot their guns and take our lives with impunity. This moment does not need more lawyers and academics who revere the law, who fear the law, who hold the law above human life. This moment calls for legal professionals and educators to use their understanding, their privilege of the law, to defend those fighting to abolish those laws that are suffocating us. And maybe I care because I've had ICE take people from my arms. I have the faces of those who have been taken, and the screams of their partners and children just etched into my memory. So every death, every detention is so personal to me because I can place 100 faces for every victim. So the question is, how do we get the Academy to care? Or better yet, how do we get you to act? So I welcome you to the resistance, and I look forward to seeing you all on the front lines, and I'm going to pass it over to Yvette, who will kind of address how you can plug in.
Thank you, Giselle. That was perfect. That was a perfect segue into what I wanted to discuss. I I have an article forthcoming in the NYU Journal of International Law and Politics called Participatory Deportation Defense, Becoming Abogados de Confianza. And in it, I'm doing a few things. One of them is tracking the history of the participatory defense movement, which started as something within the criminal legal system, really directly impacted people and their family members fighting to interrupt criminalization. And I'm tracking how the movement has evolved to now include groups like Orange County Rapid Response Network and Red de Defensas, which is a participatory defense hub that I co-founded in Tucson, Arizona, which are groups that focus on interrupting the deportation and detention systems. And it's really not a shock that this would be the evolution of the movement because immigrants are criminalized. And it's really hard to distinguish between the immigration and criminal legal systems, even though technically one is civil. And I was really honored to take part in this panel and to be partnered with Giselle because I asked her, do you call the work that you do participatory defense? And she said, no, but when I read your paper and when I read the framework, I thought that's exactly what we're doing. And that was sort of my experience with participatory defense as well. I came into the movement by supporting my friend Alejandra Pablos, who successfully defended her own deportation defense case, which she had to fight over 12 years in order to get it administratively closed. And it was through being a part of her legal defense team and us using her case as a political education tool for community to discuss the overcriminalization of Black and brown people in Tucson, to discuss the late 90s laws that criminalized legal permanent residents like herself, that I started to see the value of participatory defense, see the value of making directly impacted people and their family members the center of their own legal defense strategies. And there have definitely been other legal academics that write on this, and I'm like so personally honored to be on the same panel as Layla because her deportation abolition lawyering ethic really helped me clarify the Abogados de Confianza framework. But I think this framework is one that comes directly from undocumented people themselves. It was Alejandra Pablos fighting her own deportation case, Carla Bautista of Transqueer Pueblo coming to me and saying, there are no abogados de confianza. There aren't any lawyers that we feel we can trust. And so that made me think, well, what do we need to do in order to create lawyers that people feel they can trust? And I came up with a few things. I would say first that being an abogado de confianza is about being willing to embrace non-traditional forms of legal advocacy. It's understanding that the wins for our community can happen in the courtroom, but oftentimes happen outside of the courtroom with public pressure, media campaigns, with protest, and having lawyers actually prioritize these strategies and actually aid people in executing them. So lawyers, and I will say also that it could be controversial to, like, the Abogados de Confianza framework could be considered controversial because participatory defense really started as a movement to de-center lawyers. So I'm coming in like, wait, maybe there is a role for lawyers. But I think that there is, because even though not all wins happen in the courtroom, there is a lot that we can do within the legal system. There is a lot that direct representation can accomplish. And participatory defense strategies are so much more effective when you do have a lawyer who's like-minded and who's willing to have people pack the courtroom, because there is a reticence. There is an unwillingness amongst lawyers to not damage the reputation before the judge that they're before. And there's just a discomfort, really, with taking on these community-led strategies. And this is something that I encourage you to get comfortable with. I'll end there by just saying that there is a role for lawyers to play in supporting participatory defense, in empowering undocumented people and directly impacted people. And I think it's a tricky line in terms of still preserving the core principles of participatory defense, of honoring and prioritizing the knowledge and expertise of undocumented people while still also bringing your own legal expertise and strategies to bear. And I'm not going to say that I have it all figured out, but I encourage you all to get into the mess with me and to become abogadas de confianza.
So many of you are really like mentors and folks that I'm into, so I'm really excited to have this conversation. Before I talk about, I'm going to talk about a project I actually work with Tanya's colleague, Ray Davidson, on working with immigrant young people in a minute. But before we get there, I just want to say a word about where we are sitting. First, I'll just say, because not everyone knows this, that the land that we're sitting on used to be called Balbancha. It's like a native word for the land of many tongues. And this was an international trade hub for native people before colonization. And it obviously continues to be a place where many tribes live and thrive, and also where we continue to have just like an incredible mix of people from many cultures come here and like do beautiful cultural practices. And so I hope you get out of this space and like listen to some music and eat some food and enjoy like being in New Orleans. I also just wanted to say a word about where we sit, because Louisiana has long been one of the epicenters of immigrant detention in this country. Mm-hmm. Oakdale was the first mega immigration detention center in the 1980s. It was burned down by some of the immigrants, but then they built it back. And we continue to have more immigration detention beds than any other state save Texas, 7,000 beds. And it's, you know, I noticed like more attention to us in recent times because of the high profile cases of, you know, Mahmoud Khalil and other students being sent down here, but it's been happening for a really long time, and it's no accident. I heard the old ICE New Orleans field officer director Phil Miller once said, "We have a national immigrant detention strategy," and to mean that we don't just pick people up and detain them close to their communities. We pick people up and we like to send them to places that are far from their communities where there are few legal resources. And of course we sit in the Fifth Circuit, one of the most hostile judicial circuits for immigrants. And so this kind of compounding factors make it clear why that is the strategy. So I just wanted to kind of set the stage of where we're at, and Tanya is going to talk a lot about some of the organizing around detention, and I just was going to talk a little bit about a project that I've been working on with Ray Davidson, who's the head of, chairs the End the SIJ Backlog Coalition, which works with young people who might be seeking special immigrant juvenile status or have it, and who are seeking to end the backlog that prevents them from achieving permanence, that's keeping them in a legal limbo where they're increasingly at threat for removal. And in fact, one of our young people recently was snatched on right around high school graduation in the spring and whisked away by ICE. And within less than a day, they had removed him from the U.S., even though he actually was supposed to have removal hearing proceedings. He had an NTA filed, and he spoke up and told ICE, you know, I don't have a deportation order. I have rights. I want to talk to my lawyer. And you know, unsurprisingly, I said, you have no rights, and took him away. So I'm going to talk about this project and the, you know, we're asked to talk about like new approaches. So I'm going to talk about movement law, which is, I think, very aligned with participatory legal scholarship. Samir Asher, Jocelyn Simonson, and Amna Akbar have this Stanford Law Review article talking about movement law, which they describe as an approach to legal scholarship grounded in solidarity, accountability, and engagement with grassroots organizing and left social movements. And Rachel has called on us to engage in participatory legal scholarship by working with impacted committee members to produce scholarship that centers lived experiences in law and justice and disrupts prevailing narratives under the law. So just like as you were saying, you know, not embracing the law, but like really saying like what is the law doing and understanding like the people who are feeling the violence and oppression of the law can like define for us what the law is, what the harms are, and they should be envisioning, and you know, we as lawyers and law professors should be listening and hearing what the solutions are. And often those are outside of the law, as you've called on us to think about. But we can also, as Yvette said, like use the law. It can be a tool, and we can kind of like think together and co-generate ideas and write together. I'll just kind of that, you know, this law review article talks about movement law in four parts, like finding resistance, like finding your partner, locating it, co-generating strategies and new visions of justice. So certainly kind of like listening, working together, thinking about what the privileges that we have and like that we're not the center, but like, you know, we can work together and think about how to do that best. Shifting the knowledge base, and so again, like taking, you know, like making sure that the harms of the legal system, that the visions and the solutions that are envisioned by those directly impacted are the way that we talk about things. So, and then having a solidaristic stance. So the project that Ray and I worked on started 4 years ago, and it just started with a phone call. She called me up in the middle, you know, in the middle of the pandemic, 2020, and had read something I wrote where I had a lot of information about special immigrant juveniles, about these kids' cases. I had gotten thousands of petitions, essentially, from the immigration agency, so could see who was applying, what was happening to their applications, And at the time, people didn't know how big the backlog was, and they didn't know where the backlog was, and it was a more hopeful time because there, you know, there were some people in government willing to change some policies to think about how to support young people, and they wanted to know like what district are they in, like who, you know, and so she said, how can we find how can we get this data? Like, congressmen don't know this data. And so so I was like, yeah, I'll help you. Like, we'll draft a FOIA. I know the query and their data systems. Like, we'll tell them, like, this is a public record. Like, we'll tell them, like, what to do, and we'll get the data. And then, like, from that, you know, I'm not going to do like all the in-between steps, you know, we filed a lawsuit. We got over 200,000 records from the government. We were able to figure out what was going on. And we also kind of, you know, could see very specifically what the Trump administration had done last time with the young people's applications. They stopped adjudicating the applications, first of all. They just started peppering them, which we knew, but you could see it, like the number in 1 year that it, and then they just started denying everything. And so we were able to like pull that apart. And with the information we got, we worked with young people. Young people were trained to interview other young people to talk about their stories and to really define what the harm of being stuck in this legal limbo was. And they talked about things that we hadn't obviously thought about. And you know, every step of the way, we had to figure things out. We're like, well, you know, that they should be compensated for what they're doing. How are we going to do that? And we just kind of, you know, took it step by step. We wrote some law review articles together. We like made some, you know, reports and things. We had some education events where young people were speaking to the news and to, you know, government officials. Young people brought these to Congress. They told their stories, and there were changes. You know, DACA for SIDS youth came out of this. They got work permission. They've been spending, you know, 5 years in this legal limbo without the ability, you know, without that protection, you know, so working in very exploitative conditions, and it meant a lot. Of course, a lot has been taken away since, but there's a youth leadership council now. Young people are part of like every part of decision making in the coalition, every committee. There's a young person from the leadership council. And so it kind of really has transformed, the work has really transformed over time. There's over 500 activated SIDS youth as part of the coalition. They have the Youth Leadership Council, where in addition to making all the decisions, they train each other in what the law is and what the harms are so they can, you know, think about how to best protect themselves as they go about their day, as they navigate their worlds, and how to advocate for themselves and encounters with ICE, and how to share this information so that the law is not some mystery, but really, really, they're like leading it. And so I think I'm just going to end there. I just wanted to say, you know, I think it's a small example of movement law, and I just encourage folks to think about, there are a lot of barriers to doing this work, and we have a lot of resources, and we can be force multipliers, and we can change, we can help change the narrative, and we can help get messy together and do this work together. So thanks so much.
The Southeast Dignity Non-Detention Coalition does is supporting inside organizers, people who are detained in the ICE jails in Louisiana and Mississippi. We have 10 ICE jails in Louisiana and one in Mississippi. That doesn't include the state jails that serve as temporary holding facilities. So to say that we really deal with like a mammoth size problem is, I think, is an understatement. And so, honestly, like a big question that we constantly ask ourselves in doing this work with people who are detained on the inside is like, how do we connect with so many people who are detained when it's a few of us? And the answer is, it's a multi-pronged answer, right? So I think one thing that we've had to really determine is what are the channels of communication that are available to us to connect with people on the inside? And sometimes that means, I'm just gonna say it, like breaking the law, right? Sometimes that means like, you know, being creative and thinking outside of what we have, the tools that we have, right? And I always think about this this quote from Audre Lorde. I think, I'm pretty sure I have it right, but you cannot use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house. And although the law does, I've seen it, and the law does have its purpose as a tool, the only way that we can really like do what abolition is asking us to do and to imagine a different life-affirming reality is to shift the paradigm and really transform the way that we look at law and how it impacts people directly. And I say that because a lot of the times when I work with lawyers, we'll hit roadblocks because, oh, we can't do this, or technically we can't do that, or technically we can't do that. Well, technically ICE can't do that either, and technically CBP can't do that either. So you know what? I think we're at a time where, as my mother was a boxer, and she said, the gloves have to come off. And that's, I feel like that's where we're at, and it's gonna get messy. And I think when we're talking to people who are wanting to participate in this movement, you young people and people who are in law school, I think it's asking them to think of other tools that they have. Right, they're not just lawyers. You know, you might be able to cook, right? And so you might be able to support, you know, groups, community groups with that, and not necessarily just lawyering, right? There's so many lawyers who come into spaces who are just like, I'm the lawyer, right? This is, I'm on the legal committee, I'm on this. Well, I think you should challenge yourselves and go to a different committee, do something else that's not just lawyering, because it requires that in order to meet this movement now. And especially as Layla was saying, like, where it's the scarcity of resources in Louisiana, but across all Southeast states is bleak, you know? And so we have to really like wear different hats in this movement, and people inside detention centers, they have to do the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's somebody, Nilson Barahona, who was detained in Irwin Detention Center in Georgia. I remember him saying that, like, you know, part of the conversations that he has with people in detention is like teaching them how to be creative about, like, you know, how to make tamales with what's in the detention centers, but also, like, you know, explaining that that's a way to also build relationships, because at its core, organizing is building relationships. And I see a lot of lawyers who get physically uncomfortable being in spaces with organizers or even people directly impacted. And I think I challenge people to really lean into that discomfort, because that, you know, when you lean into that discomfort, you're opening ways to build trust with somebody. And if you're asking organizers and lawyers to be together and to work together, that has to come at the speed of trust. And it means, you know, it means challenging some of the preconceived ways that we might operate. I think the other thing the coalition does is detention visitation, right? So like, I've been doing this work for, five years now. And detention centers, and even, you know, Bambi's here, you know, she can speak to this, but like, it is one of the cruelest forms of state violence that I have really seen. And and I have privilege, right? I'm the children of immigrants. I was born here. I'm from Queens. I'm from New York. And I've seen some things, but I've never really seen that form of violence until I came here to the South and saw the inside of an ICE jail. And I don't know how people like Bambi is a miracle. Like, I don't know how people survive that. And it's hard. I'm sorry to get emotional. Part of that work that we do is go to the detention centers, right? And so I think another thing for you as professors is to, like, get out of a classroom, get out of this hotel, get out and go to where people are and where people are being impacted by these systems of oppression and speak to them and listen. You know, as an organizer, I was always taught 80% of your conversation with somebody should be listening. Mm-hmm. And 20%, less than that, should be you speaking. And I think that's how you learn a lot about, you know, how are we moving away from, like, you know, how can we really work to dismantle these systems that cause this violence? And so going back to, like, the detention centers, right? So, like, with Tulane as well, like, we partner with other schools, Cornell as well, and other national organizations to go into the detention centers and conduct legal rights presentations. And in a sense, we are trying to democratize and, you know, the legal information that so many lawyers hold on to, because 7,000 beds, there are not 7,000 lawyers to represent those 7,000 people. And so people have to take, you know, their own defense into their own hands. That's if they choose to do that, right? Because, you know, right now people in detention are looking at anywhere from 6 months to a year detained, fighting doing deportation defense, fighting their case. And a lot of people make the decision to say no. And that's their right, you know? Mm-hmm. So part of our, when we go to the detention centers, we're really just giving people the information. At times, people don't even know where they are. Like, some of our presentations start with, you are in Louisiana, in the Southeast United States. People will be like, oh, I thought I was in Texas. I thought I was in Mississippi. The level of disorientation that happens in these detention centers really impacts people's mental well-being as well. And so when we're there, like, you know, you can't just jump into the law. You know, you have to really talk to a person and really empathize with them and connect with them at a human level, because people are living through trauma. And when you're living through trauma and you're trying to explain what a petition for habeas corpus is, like, it's just gonna go over their head. And so part of the legal rights presentation, honestly, is it starts with just trying to build trust with that person. And because every person in the detention setting is somebody that has caused them harm or somebody that they can't trust. And so, you know, that's another thing that we really want to emphasize in our work is as a coalition. Like, I know that there's purpose in mobilizations and being in the streets and direct action, but I think the hardest work is behind the scenes. And so we really invest in training, leadership development of people who were previously detained, because they have the lived experiences and they are the best advocates for an alternative life-affirming system. And I think part of, you know, working with lawyers is taking the lead of those directly impacted. And maybe that means you don't do the sexy litigation. Maybe that means you're stuck in the courtroom, maybe doing merits cases. Sometimes that's what the community needs of you. And I tell you from personal experience, like, just, you know, when organizations or, you know, big groups like parachute in, you know, especially as Layla was saying, we had these high profile cases, Mahmoud Khalil, Mesa Ozturk, and Louisiana started getting more attention. But this problem has been here for a long time. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, how are you building, you know, lasting relationships? How are you moving from rapid response to actually building community, building coalition? Because that, in the end, is what's going to really, that's what's proving right now to be a form of surviving. Like, we are in the middle of a crisis right now in New Orleans and many other states, Minneapolis, Chicago, LA, you know, mm-hmm. have seen the violence at the hands of ICE and CBP. And we're in the middle of, you know, Operation Catahoula Crunch. And so there are people who I wish could have taken my place here today, because they are the people who are living through this, but they're sheltering in place. You know, and so what does it mean as a lawyer to support in these ways? And You know, sometimes that means just getting out of a classroom, out of a courtroom, and picking up, you know, a pen, you know, or going outside and doing something else that's not lawyering. And I think I'll stop there, because I don't know how much time we have, but.
We don't have a lot of time, but I would love to hear some thoughts or questions from all of you, or ideas of what you've been thinking about how to engage. I do want to say that Giselle is my former student, so I like to believe I have a little bit in not breaking her entirely.
Yes.
Yeah, come to the mic.
How loud I am. Thank you, oh my God, so much for this incredible panel. I'm Paulina, I teach at Michigan. Before I was a book professor, I worked at CASA. And I've been trying to figure out how to educate this generation of law students who I think mostly law students as a category are really not primed to think in this way. You know, they come from undergrad, they're often, even if they're from directly impacted communities, I like my way to help my community is to like really keep my head down and like move forward and like get a firm job. And I started teaching a small class called like Lawyering When the Law Is Against You, where I just bring folks in to try to like build the imagination of law students who are doing this work in a lot of different areas, in women's rights, in prisoners' rights, and trans rights, so they can start learning what scrappy lawyering looks like and how people build that. But there are, you know, I watch my students almost get overwhelmed. They're just like, wow, you guys are so cool and you do so much, and here I am with my debt and I'm already a 2L or a 3L, like a firm's already come in and tried to get me a job for after law school, and I'm just wondering sort of, and I try to say, be a human first, get involved in your community, there's a lot you can do, like even if you're a firm, like use your money, you know, use your time, but what would you say to sort of this generation of law students to help them feel more empowered to do this work, and also not to just, it's like we're trying to get them to be a human, but you're also, I've noticed some of the movement law rhetoric has caused some students to go in and be like, well, I should be an organizer and I'm going to walk into this community that I'm not embedded in yet and like try to take it over, right? And it's like, no, you're still a lawyer, you have legal skills, like you're supporting the imagination of organizers, you like have these skills. But I'd just love to hear sort of how you think we should be inspiring and like empowering this generation of students.
Thank you. I'm probably the most recent law student on the panel. I have some thoughts. I think Professor Aldana is a living example of what an incredible law professor can do for a law student. I came into the space already knowing that I probably wasn't going to like anybody. But then I got there and I was like, wow, I really hate this place. I thought about dropping out, and I expressed that on my 1L year to Professor Aldana. But I was lucky. I had Professor Aldana my first semester for crim law. And I think what she did was create a space where she gave us almost permission in this otherwise conservative bubble to toy around with different possibilities of what the law could look like and what resistance could even look like. I mean, I'll say it in that class, you know, when we were talking about gun rights and movement work, I was immediately like, yeah, we gotta arm the people, right?
That was a moment.
But she didn't chastise me for that, right? She was a little bit nervous about how to navigate that moment, but she embraced that, right? And so I always knew I had that space to go within this nightmare that I could feel safe, right? And that I could advance, you know, radical thought in such a conservative space. And so I think just it sounds like you're doing amazing, but then also encourage people and students to go into the community, because that is what
has to inform our approach every step of the way. It has to be based on community input and their experiences. So, and last thing I'm going to say is, you don't have to come out a lawyer. Yes, we do need lawyers, and the work that is done is still vital to movement work, but it's not the only outcome. And if people feel that they can better serve this movement in different capacities, then that can absolutely be embraced and developed, so that we're not just a factory kind of robot lawyers, which is what it felt like to me.
I mean, the only thing I'll add to that is this is really the fight of our generation or generations. I mean, if we think about colonialism or European colonialism has only been around about 7 generations. And despite all attempts to the contrary, they haven't been able to take out of existence indigenous people and black people. And so I think that is a testament of our survival. And what we're seeing now is horrendous, is magnifying, but it's the beginning of immense violence and terror that is going to be deployed upon these lands again, or that has been deploying. And so it's, in some ways, it's not a fear tactic, but it's really a call to courage, because we need to do it, and we need each other, and we need everyone. And we need every tactic. You know, pathways to liberation are not outlined for us. I think we have examples, as Cynthia pointed out to us. But we're going to have to do this together to get out of it. And I don't know if Cynthia wants to add anything to that question.
I do think we're out of time.
Okay.
But what we just said.
I do want to add something to it.
You want to add something? Okay, like, we'll just stay for until they kick us out. And if you guys want to stick around, I can have this conversation for a long time.
Okay.
Yeah, please.
I hate this thing so heavy. I think we just, you know, this space, again, as I said earlier, right, like, it's not traditionally made for people like us, right? And so, like, I think we need to think before that, before people enter into the space, like, how is it that we're going to support people, right? Because I know that a lot of times for people like us, like, we get into the space because of the injustices that we experience, right? And so how do we build a new wave of leaders, right? Because also, like, this is so expensive, right? Who has the money and the time when we're trying to organize and trying to support our people, right? And so, like, I think we want to think about, like, you know, funding, actually, you know, to bring the new wave of leaders.
I think that law school has, like, the word Simon song is, like, in my mind, but there's this, like, overpowering, like, stories that are being told to students time after time. Or so, you have to do this thing, and then you do this thing, and then you do this thing, and these decisions that you're making now are for, like, 2 years from now, and then for your whole life. And we do have to break that down, like, also. We just have to demystify, like, people are all going to tell you that this, like, 10 people are going to tell you the same thing, but actually they might all be wrong. And you can do it differently, and it may feel a lot harder, but, like, here are all of the examples of people who have done it differently. And so some students may just, like, need to pay for their mom's, like, health bill. You know, they may need to, like, make some decisions in the short term, but they also have to understand, like, that they're the ones making the decisions, and that they don't have to listen, and that there are different ways, and you can change paths at any time, and that we work to live. We don't live to work. And so, like, what is the life that you want? And, like, what is the community that you're working for? And you know, maybe you can do it differently. Like, I'm not going to prescribe that, you know?
Yeah.
I can't thank you for coming enough. And
thank you.
Amazing group of people who are giving us, I think, prescriptions, but also just the example of what hope, disciplined hope, looks like in this moment. So thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thank you.